This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. In January, I was appointed the next Poet Laureate of Sonoma County, serving for the years 2014 through 2015. And I have a Poet Laureate project that I want to start the program out with tonight. So listen up and get your pens ready, and I hope you'll take part in this project. It's called Digging Our Poetic Roots. I will regularly select a number of poems over the two-year period that I'm Poet Laureate to share electronically with you, our local communities, through various means. My Word Temple email blast, Poets in the Schools, the Sonoma County Literary Guide, any way I can get it out there. And I'll point out, when applicable, which school or movement of poetry each poem represents, the different aspects of each poem that help shape it, things like rhythm, types of rhymes, white space, meter, etc. I'll share comments about the poem by the poet, her or himself, whenever possible, and then put out writing prompts, inviting you, Sonoma County, to respond with poems of your own. Everyone is invited to participate, experienced and inexperienced, young and old. We will all learn, or relearn in some cases, together as we visit or revisit the poems and topics at hand, myself included. I will invite guest editors to participate in the reading of these poems and in the selection of poems to be published in the culminating project, an anthology of Sonoma County poets. Following publication of the anthology, I will coordinate readings to be held throughout Sonoma County and record some of the poets for this program on KRCB. The project will exercise our poetic muscles of anyone who participates and increase exposure to the burgeoning community of poets in Sonoma County. So we'll dig our roots, both by looking deeply into poems and by enjoying the whole process start to finish. So if this project sounds like something you would like to participate in, you can contact me or, pass the word around to people, including children, that you think might like to get involved. I can be reached at khastings@wordtemple.com. The first portion of tonight's program goes hand in hand with Digging Our Poetic Roots. I'll be playing a type of poetry party, lots of poems read by different poets, reflecting their different styles and their different way of presenting their work as well. And then I'll air an interview I held with the poet Nicole Brown, a former Kentucky poet who now teaches at the University of Arkansas. So let's turn to the poetry party now. I'm going to start off with three poems. The first one is by, I think, one of the greatest American poets of our time, the late Robert Duncan. The poem is called Often I Am Permitted to Return to a Meadow. Duncan wrote when he was 34 years old, "I make poetry as other men make war, or make love, or make states or revolutions, to exercise my faculties at large." Listen carefully to the cadences of this poem, to the rhymes and the almost rhymes. This is Often I Am Permitted to Return to a Meadow. And following Duncan, I'll play Dorothy Parker and Etheridge Knight. Unfortunately, with Knight's poem, I have to edit out one word that is not allowed on the radio. Okay, here we go.
Often I Am Permitted to Return to a Meadow was written in London in January of 1953. Often I am permitted to return to a meadow as if it were a scene made up by the mind that is not mine, but is a made place. That is mine, it is so near to the heart, an eternal pasture folded in all thought, so that there is a hall therein. That is a made place, created by light, wherefrom the shadows that are forms fall. Wherefrom fall all architectures I am, I say are likenesses of the first beloved, whose flowers are flames lit to the lady. She it is, queen under the hill, whose hosts are a disturbance of words within words, that is a field folded. It is only a dream of the grass blowing east against the source of the sun in an hour before the sun's going down, whose secret we read in a children's game of ring around of roses told. Often I am permitted to return to a meadow as if it were a given property of the mind that certain bounds hold against chaos. That is a place of first permission, everlasting omen of what is.
One perfect rose. A single flower he sent me since we met. All tenderly his messenger he chose. Deep-hearted, pure, with scented dew still wet. One perfect rose. I knew the language of the floweret. My fragile leaves, it said, his heart enclose. Love long has taken for his amulet one perfect rose. Why is it no one ever sent me yet one perfect limousine, do you suppose? Ah, no, it's always just my luck to get one perfect rose.
This next poem is titled Belly Song for the Daytop Family. And it begins with some lines by Sarah Mansfield. Those lines go, "You have made something out of the sea that blew and rolled you on its salt, bitter lips. It nearly swallowed you. But I hear you are tough and harder to swallow than most." Belly song. And I must admit that the sea in you has sung to the sea in me. And I must admit that the sea in me has fallen in love with the sea in you, because you have made something out of the sea that nearly swallowed you. And this poem I give to you. This poem is a song I sing to you from the bottom of the sea in my belly. This poem is a song about feelings. About the bone of feeling, about the stone of feeling, and the feather of feeling. This poem is a death chant and a gravestone and a prayer for the dead, for young Jackie Robinson, a moving black warrior who walked among us with a wide stride and heavy heels, moving through the blood and mud and shit of Vietnam, moving through the blood and mud and dope of America, for Jackie, who was a song and a stone and a feather of feeling, now dead and gone in this month of love. This poem is for me and the days that lay in the back of my mind when the sea rose up to swallow me and the streets I walked were lonely streets, were stone cold streets. This poem is for me and the nights when I wrapped my feelings in a sheet of ice and stared at the stars through iron bars and cried in the middle of my eyes. This poem is for me and my woman and the yesterdays when she opened to me like a flower and I fell on her like a stone. I fell on her like a stone. And now, in my 40th year, I have come here to this house of feelings, to this singing sea. And I must admit that the sea in me has fallen in love with the sea in you. Because the sea that now sings in you is the same sea that nearly swallowed you and me too.
Okay, let's continue this poetry party. Here are three more. The first I'll play is a recording of Anne Sexton reading her poem, The Truth the Dead Know. Following Sexton, Theodore Retke reads My Papa's Waltz. And finally, the poet Emily Dickinson, read by Teresa Gallagher, the poem begins, I Cannot Live With You. Here we go.
The Truth the Dead Know. And it was written after my father's funeral, which was just 3 months after my mother's. The truth the dead know. Gone, I say, and walk from church, refusing the stiff procession to the grave, letting the dead ride alone in the hearse. It is June. I am tired of being brave. We drive to the Cape. I cultivate myself, a blushing hermit in the sun, where the sea swings in like an iron gate, and I turn to you and am bright and young. My love, the wind falls in like stones from a white mountain, and where we touch, we are twice marked and twice alone. Men kill for this, or for as much. And what would the dead say? What defiles their calm eyes and their loose brows? Not this, for through their tiny smiles they mutter, "Live now, live now."
My papa's waltz. The whiskey on your breath could make a small boy dizzy. But I hung on like death. Such waltzing was not easy. We romped until the pans slid from the kitchen shelf. My mother's countenance could not unfrown itself. The hand that held my wrist was battered on one knuckle. At every step you missed, my right ear scraped a buckle. You beat time on my head with a palm caked hard by dirt, then waltzed me off to bed, still clinging to your shirt.
I cannot live with you. It would be life, and life is over there, behind the shelf the sexton keeps the key to, putting up our life, his porcelain, like a cup discarded of the housewife, quaint or broken. A newer Sèvres pleases, old ones crack. I could not die with you, for one must wait to shut the other's gaze down. You could not. And I, could I stand by and see you freeze, without my right of frost, death's privilege? Nor could I rise with you, because your face would put out Jesus, that new grace glow plain and foreign on my homesick eye, except that you than he shone closer by. They'd judge us. How? For you served heaven, you know, or sought to. I could not, because you saturated sight, and I had no more eyes for sordid excellence as paradise. And were you lost, I would be, though my name rang loudest on the heavenly fame. And were you saved, and I condemned to be where you were not, that self were hell to me. So we must keep apart, you there, I here, with just the door ajar that oceans are, and prayer, and that pale sustenance, despair.
The next three poets up on this poetry party segment of the show are Michael McClure, Carolyn Kaiser, and Allen Ginsberg. Michael McClure read for the Word Temple Poetry Series years ago. I hope you were there to hear it. He is one of the remaining true beat poets out of the San Francisco era, and he was a young man when he read at the Six Gallery along with Allen Ginsberg. He often performs his poetry with music. He has performed with Terry Riley and with the great Ray Manzarek, the late keyboardist with the Doors. So Michael McClure will perform Plumstones, followed by Carolyn Kaiser reading An American Beauty, and finally, Allen Ginsberg reading his very funny poem, "Come on, pigs of Western civilization, eat more grease." So here are three more poems to show you the great diversity that poetry can be.
Fog. Fog around rainbows. Rainbow in clear light. horse heads like eagles, eagles like horse heads, zooming through storms, big drops splashing on the redwood deck rail, inner and outer realm mated in sizelessness, rainbows pouring in waterfalls, waterfalls gurgling in streams of childhood, compassion swirling through mercy. Birth goes out with a light bulb. Always here, in continuous practice, a brown moth resting on old lace, and a can of peaches in tomorrow's firelight. Plum. Somewhere a plum is ripe, swirling like horse heads in rainbows. Purple plum, green plum, blue, black, edging through white with hands in prayer. Ordinary as palm, pressed to palm in a mudra. Bowing and blessing after all these years. A plum is ripe. Cold, hard, gold-brown pears in the rain by the eaves, alert bare branches, like kitten fur and deer eyes, plain as a skid mark. Ordinary, ordinary as bowing in blessing, zooming through storms. Eagles like horse heads. Horse heads like eagles. Fog. Fog around rainbows. Plain as skid marks. Ordinary. Ordinary as bowing in blessing. Ordinary as palm pressed to palm in a mudra.
Well, this is to a friend of mine who has been dead for 20 years. I'm a very slow take on many things. It's called An American Beauty, and it's dedicated to Ann London, someone that both Stanley and Dave knew. An American Beauty. As you described your mastectomy in calm detail and bared your chest so I might see the puckered scar, they took a hatchet to your breast, I said. What an Amazon you are. When we were girls, we climbed Mount Tamalpais, chewing bay leaves we had plucked along the way. We got high, all right, from animal pleasure in each other, shouting to the sky. On your houseboat, we tried to ignore the impossible guy you had married to enrage your family, a typical ploy. We were great fools let loose in the no-name bar on Sausalito's Bay. In San Francisco, we'd perch on a waterfront pier, chewing sourdough and cheese, swilling champagne, kicking our heels, crooning lewd songs, hooting like seagulls. We bayed with the seals. Then you married someone in Mexico, broke up in 2 weeks, didn't bother to divorce. Claimed it didn't count. You dumped number three, fled to Albany to become a pedant. Averse to domesticity, you read for your PhD. Your four-year-old looked like a miniature John Lennon. You fed him peanut butter from the jar and raised him on Beowulf and Grendel. Much later in New York, we reunited. In an elevator at Saks, a woman asked for your autograph. You glowed like a star, like Anouk Aimée at 40, close enough. Your pedantry found its place in the women's movement. You rose fast, seen suddenly as the morning star, wrote the ERA, Found the right man at last, a sensitive artist. Flying too high not to crash. When the cancer caught you, you went on talk shows to say you had no fear or faith. In Baltimore, we joked on your bed as you turned into a witty wraith. When you died, I cleaned out your bureau drawers, your usual disorder, an assortment of gorgeous wigs and prosthetic breasts, tossed in garbage bags to spare your gentle spouse. Then the bequests you had made to every friend you had, for each of us a necklace or a ring, a snapshot for me. We two, barefoot in chiffon, laughing under blossoms, your last wedding day.
Come on, pigs of Western civilization, eat more grease. Eat, eat more marbled sirloin, more pork and gravy. Lard up the dressing. Fry chicken in boiling oil. Carry it dribbling to gray clime, snowed with salt. Little lambs covered with mint, roast in racks, surrounded by roast potatoes wet with butter sauce. Buttered veal medallions in creamy saliva. Buttered beef by glistening mountains of French fries. Stroganoffs in white hot sour cream. Chops soaked in olive oil, surrounded by olives, salty feta cheese, followed by Roquefort and Blue and Stilton, thirsty for wine. Beer, Coca-Cola, Fanta, Champagne, Pepsi, Retsina, Arak, Whiskey, Vodka. Ah! Watch out, heart attack. Pop some angina pills. Order a plate of bratwurst. Fried frankfurters. Couple billion wimpies. McDonald burgers to the moon and burp. Salt on those fries. Boil onions and breaded mushroom, even zucchini, in deep, hot Crisco pans. Turkeys die only once. Look nice next to tall white glasses, sugar milk, and ice cream vanilla balls. Strawberry for sweeter color milkshakes with hot dogs. Forget green beans. Every day a few carrots. A mini big spoonful of salty rice will do. Make the plate pretty. Throw in some vinegar pickles, briny sauerkraut. Check your cholesterol. Swallow a pill and order a sugar cream donut. Pack two under your size 44 belt. Pass out in the vomitorium. Come back coughing up strands of sandwich. Still chewing pastrami at Katz's Delicatessen. Back to Central Europe and gobble kielbasa in Wurz. Swallow salami in Munich with beer, liverwurst on pumpernickel in Berlin, greasy cheese on in a three-star hotel near Syntagma on white bread, thick buttered. Set an example for the developing nations. Salt, sugar, animal fat, coffee, tobacco, schnapps. Drop dead faster. Make room for Chinese guest workers with alien soybean curds. Green cabbage and rice. Africans, Latins with rice, beans, and calabash can stay thin in crowded apartments for working-class food freaks. Not like Western cuisine, rich in protein, cancer, heart attack, hypertension, sweat, bloated liver and spleen, megaly, diabetes and stroke, monuments to carnivorous civilizations presently murdering Belfast, Bosnia, Cyprus, Nagorno-Karabakh, Georgia, mailing love letter bombs in Vienna, or setting houses afire in East Germany. Have another coffee. Here's a cigar. And this is a plate of black forest chocolate cake. You deserve it.
And with that, I will conclude this portion of the radio program. This all has to do with Digging Our Poetic Roots, my project as Sonoma County's new poet laureate. If you would like to participate in this project, receiving poems from me, receiving writing prompts from me, and possibly being published in an anthology of Sonoma County poems, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com, and we'll get you writing. Okay, up next I'm going to play an interview with the poet Nicole Brown. Nicole lived in Kentucky most of her life. She was an editor with Saraband Books. She lives in Arkansas now, teaching at the University of Arkansas, but she was in Sonoma County in early January of this year, and I was able to nab her for an interview. So we'll move on to that interview with Nicole shortly, but First, here is our regular musical interlude. Be back in a minute. Okay, that was Pink Martini performing their song Andalusia. Let's move on now to my interview with the poet Nicole Brown. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. This is Catherine Hastings. My next guest is Nicole Brown, who is here from Arkansas. How are you, Nicole?
Good, good.
It's good to see you again. We first met when we were both attending Vermont College of the Arts, getting our master's in writing. And that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But the last time I saw you was in 2007, mm-hmm. when the Word Temple Poetry Series was in its first season, mm-hmm. and you read there with Judy Gron.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
so
right. In 2008.
Oh, was it 2008?
Yes.
Okay, well, it was still a long time ago. So your book at that time was called Sisters, and it was published by Red Hen Press. Mm-hmm. And now you have a second full-length collection of poetry coming out. What is that book called, and who's publishing it?
It's called Fanny Says, and Boa Editions will be bringing that out in May of 2015.
Congratulations.
Thank
a great
you.
Publisher.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
That's wonderful.
Well, you've given a number of readings over the years, and one that jumped out at me was you gave a reading with Gregory Corso and Allen Ginsberg in 1994. Where was that? Tell me about it.
Oh, my. That had been a long time ago. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and coming out of high school into undergraduate at the University of Louisville, there was a ragtag group of young poets, and we pulled together a group called Rant for the Literary Renaissance. This is a very long time ago. And we started inviting all of these poets down to Louisville. There was a poet by the name of Ron Whitehead who was sort of spearheading a lot of this. And somehow we managed it and we brought them into Louisville. Sometime later, we were all invited to give a reading at NYU. And so we went up for that and had no money and slept in Washington Square Park and made the best of it. But it was, I Forrest Gumped my way through the whole thing. I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah. How old were you at that time?
Oh.
1994.
Good Lord. 20, maybe.
Oh, okay.
1920.
Yeah. Did you know at the time, you know, all about Ginsberg and...
No. No, not really.
You were just there reading with some people.
Which to my benefit, you know, that I didn't have that kind of pressure on me, you know, and I mean, I knew, but I didn't really know.
Right.
You know. So.
And you have another pretty famous person that you have dealt with in the past, and that's Hunter S. Thompson.
That's right.
You worked for him. Under what capacity?
I was his editorial assistant. This wasn't too long after everything, you know, happened in 94. I think this would have been 97 or so. He invited me out to the farm to help with a book that he couldn't finish. Hunter's actually from Louisville.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that's what that connection is. And yeah.
Okay. So. Well, you are now assistant professor of English at the University of Arkansas in Little Rock.
That's right. Yeah.
And before that, you actually worked for Sarah Band Books for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. Are they still going strong?
Yes, they're doing very well.
That's another fine publisher.
I absolutely love Sarah Band. I miss it, but I'm glad I'm teaching now. It was a good change for me to make. But Sarah Band's doing great.
Good. Well, let's turn to your latest book, which is called Fanny Says. And so tell us who Fanny is before you start reading.
Fanny is my maternal grandmother. My mother had me very young, so by all rights, she raised me or had a really strong hand in raising me. Fanny is from Western Kentucky, from Bowling Green. And I didn't know it when I was young, but as I got older, I certainly realized there was no one else like her on the planet. And she was a storyteller, and she was just wonderful. And she passed away in 2004. And one of the things I realized when I was starting this next book is that I didn't want her story to disappear. My sisters have children now, and the grandkids in the family, they don't know her. They don't know her story, her personality. And so I started to write these poems.
That's great. Yeah. Well, go ahead and read from Fanny Says.
Sure. I'll start with a poem. This is actually the first one in the collection, and it's kind of a preface or a dedication, I should say. It's called For Our Grandmothers. For our grandmothers, all of them, who clutched their pocketbooks, who hid the money for the light bill and the Bible, who counted, and recounted stacks of towels. For our grandmothers who stored the white wax of bacon grease in a coffee can, who tossed table salt over their shoulders, who had rules about stepping under ladders, eating the table's last biscuit in the acceptable distance hemmed up from a girl's knee. For our grandmothers who would not let us call her grandmother, who wanted to be called anything but grandma, for they were too young to be a mother when they became mothers, and then you. For our grandmothers who made us pick our own switch, who spooned hot coffee into a saucer, then sipped from the edge. For our grandmothers who would not call a cicada, but a locust, a 13-year plague of them, making an apocalypse of June. For our grandmothers who considered a cat a tail switch shadow that could slip under your bedroom door, take your breath from you, then smother the baby in its sleep. To grandmothers like eagles, accumulating each nest through generations until it's too heavy and breaks its own branch. To grandmothers like swiftlets with nothing, who made strong, translucent nests from their own spit. For our grandmothers who thought there's a white right way and a wrong way, right is right, wrong's wrong, ain't no sense in between. For grandmothers who emptied their husbands' fish gut buckets and bore enough children to run out of names. For my grandmother who snatched me from the nurse and wrapped me in her old mink coat. It was cold, almost spring, and though I was bruised yellow with jaundice, she took us on out of that hospital, settling her weary daughter, a new mother, careful in the back, with no talk of shoulder belts or infant seats or airbags. It was simple. She held me up front for my first ride. Her maid turned the key. I slept warm. So warm in her arms, we were on our way. She took us on home. This next piece is called Your Monthly. And one of the things I did in this book was to try to suss out her way of speaking in her stories. And so, Your Monthly. Your monthly is what her mama called it. But what I want is a word for the year she bled freely, a wad of old wash rags, each end pinned to a belt around her waist. A word for 12 happy deaths, each unfertilized cell that washed out saying, "Not yet, Fanny. You still just a child yourself." Because this world knows a girl of 16's too old to be playing cowboys and Indians, but also knows how young she was when, stiff red feather in her hair, she scrambled inside hollering, "Mama, come quick, I'm about to bleed to death." A word for the year she learned to walk in red shoes pulled from some rich lady's trash, the sound of those heels down the hall, two guns cocking with quick clicks, a sound to hide from her daddy in the morning, eating his breakfast of milk and corn pone with a spoon. A word for the time before that man swaggered in, bought her a phosphate, bought her her very first bra, then took her to the movies to see a child's cartoon with dwarves impossibly happy to work in the mines. A year later, she was expecting. Though what exactly I was expecting, she told me, I couldn't have said. A word, please, somebody, give me. For that season with her uterus, small and tight, is an unedible green pear, her body keening and cramped in its stall. A word for all things not yet stretched to bits, a word for all things not yet broken. A word for all things left unbroken, a word for breakable yet unbroken things, a word for unbroken expectant things. Tell me, what is that word? Say it. Say it. Say it. This poem is called Go Put On Your Face. Go put on your face is what she said, but what she meant was a little something something, a little dunk-a-dunk, a little mascara and blush, gloss and perfume, and better conceal that stork bite, that hot V that flared between my brows, that red check pointing down to my pink gum-flavored gum, chewed and blown and popped with a flirt, me pulling it to string and twirling it with the tip, just like a dumb blonde should. Spit that gum out now and hurry. Go put on your face. We got to go, she said, because who knows who might see me eyeing glossies at the checkout, studying women on the cover who don't let their self go. No, not for a second. They keep their pretty selves up. They know how to contour, how to highlight, how to erase their face into a foundation to build new. How to shadow deep crease shadows in their come sit your handsome self down here gaze. I was taught, without your face put on, your face is a turnip jerked round and pale from mud, that your face without your face put on is flat-footed, a gal fanning herself with her own apron. A daughter with eyes too far apart that don't know no better, bless her heart. And what girl don't need a little color? What girl don't need those tiny boxes of pressed powder to catch sparks? Those applicators and brushes and wands to change her, saying you came from something even though you ain't from nothing. Saying a good man, he's gonna find you, gonna keep you, and someday, yes, someday, even a kitchen all your own. You see, child, you listen to your grandmama. Someday a kitchen all your own, the air so high, the cool will crank through the vents like money. Your husband coming home any minute now, 'cause he works hard for you, and he's coming home to sheets hot from the dryer and all that cool inside. He's, honey, I'm home through the door, and you're there, feet up, cared for as a hothouse orchid, pedicured and manicured and foil bleached bright. And if you want to keep him, best put on that face every damn night. This next piece is it's called For My Grandmother's Feet, Swollen Again. But for one pair of lace-up boots, your feet grew up barefoot with no idea you'd be bedridden. Expecting for the last time at 40. In your sixth child, your youngest daughter, my mother, would play shoe shop with a string. It's her favorite story, how she laced your feet with pretend ribbon, pretend satin, pretend lace, how she tied a bow and said, how about this pair, Mama? Would these do? I can't say I was there, but the half of me that was round and fully formed nested in the mouth of the swan, waiting to be allowed down the long swan throat. And at times, when I'm too sick to get out of bed, I curl the edge of a haunted sheet between my toes to feel a pair of imaginary slippers made by a little girl who waits for me at the edge of my bed. This memory, is it mine to have? My feet are three sizes too big, paddle feet, unpolished feet that never bore the weight of child and might never will. But still, when my body fevers, when I'm weak, when there is something bittersweet threading the loneliest part of me, something says, now, it's time. I've made you new shoes. Stand up. One of the things that I wanted to write about that was difficult was that my grandmother, since a relatively young age, was prescribed phenobarbital by her doctor, and by the time she got older, it became more and more difficult for her to get her prescription, but she had to have it because she was so addicted. And there was one place in Louisville in which I could get the drug for her and send it to her when she was down in Florida by this time, but I was still in Kentucky. So this is a poem about that. It's called Fino. Fino, as in barbitol, as in luminol, as in an injection gone wrong that stopped the apricot hearts of 50 institutionalized children before the Second War. Fino, as in barbiturate, designed to depress, to hypnotize a seizure with the static of its blank screen, pills like snowflakes to slow the body's quick ticking to a single white note that's not happy exactly, but too leveled to care. Fino, as in the quack days when a dentist diagnosed gum disease and convinced her to have every tooth jerked out of her pretty face before she hit 36. As in the quack days when she opened her legs for a douche singed with Lysol to keep herself fresh. Back when folks died of ptomaine poisoning from punctured cans and cigarettes assisted safe delivery. Smoking being a good way to keep the baby from being too fat to birth. Used before the FDA and never formally cleared, Fino is a renegade drug, a cowboy hee-hawing outside town, not giving a damn. So it makes sense for 40 years she popped them whenever she felt frayed. Coey, I'm a wreck. Could you go get Grandma her nerve pills? Fino, because some things he did right. You can take the medicine, Fanny, he said, but no wife of mine's getting shocked. That was when women didn't get depressed or upset, but had full-on nervous breakdowns, and for that, applied warm gel to both temples and enough voltage to make a bad thought into a small, wild canary about to land before, bye-bye birdie, it just flies off. Fino, pronounced Fee-no, a good name for a horse, a twitchy filly ridden by an 89-pound jockey in pink and green silks, a smart little switch in his hand. Watch her come down the inside line. She's a beauty, every bit as fast as the boys. She's making a run for the roses until the mud catches her deep stride, snaps her femur, and from the stands you watch them put her down, a thing gone from majesty to dog food right there on the track. All bets off, you cross Central from Churchill Downs, find Granger's Pharmacy, the only place that will still fill a prescription that went out with Technicolor film. Behind a bookie board soda fountain is Mr. Granger. He expects you. He knows why you've come. He has the yellow bottle waiting and never charges you a dime. If this is drug running, you don't care. You always do as she says. Every month, you pick it up, package it, and mail it priority to her on the coast. Fino, a drug known to work different on the old, making the elderly hyperactive, restless, unable to sleep, up at 3 a.m. wondering who stole her pretty aqua hand towels in that new yellow bowl, accusing her son of trying to kill her by bringing home a clearance picking of culls, grainy tomatoes, and chicken black to the bone. Fino, as in her stash of hundreds of pills scrawled away in the bottom dresser drawer she couldn't bend down to reach no more. By then, she was so sick, she was sucking rock salt off pretzels and throwing the rest in the trash. An iron deficiency, someone said, a loss of blood. I held the bottles in my hand, wondered how many I could swallow down before I became the smooth water of her satin quilt. She woke then and did something she hardly ever did. She said my full name. Nicole, where are you? Well, okay. I was just making sure you didn't go. Grandma needs you here. I couldn't see you down on the floor. I wasn't sure where you was. I put the pills back, closed the drawer, turned out her bedroom light. So this next piece is called Flitter. And I have yet to find a family that uses the word flitter, but you out there listening, maybe you can contact me and let me know if your family uses this word in the same way. Flitter is what she said, but what she meant had nothing to do with the lighting from one bloom to the next by a monarch or an equally colorful diva at the bar. What she meant was your privates, your girly parts, something you better soap up daily and watch like a spectacled hawk. It was code, really, a kid-friendly word like every Christ-fearing family has, something to sidestep the gynecological genitals and its speculum-chilled vagina, something that wasn't her sex, a word that said Colette, both verb and noun, exhaling the same thin gentlewoman cigar. Hers is a word rated PG, something that wasn't once an innocent kitty in boots that now swung practically buck naked from a pole, and never do you hear flitter in any bass-thumping salt and pepper my mango vajayjay songs. No, flitter is lyrical but awkward. Despite its featherweight meaning, it never does fly. To me, flitter sounds heavy, ironic, with the phonic aptitude of a frying pan, a word a little too natural, perhaps, in need of a shave. What kept it alive was that F sound, slightly transgressive, ready to leap off the four-letter cliff, but more so it echoed with fat and flat, the two qualities of a flitter Fanny found. A baby girl, for example, was always born with a fat flitter, and that's exactly what she would be called. And then there was fat as a flitter, applying to cute, chunky things like chipmunk cheeks and toddler's wrists and puppy dogs. Then, of course, there was flat, a more mature version of the same, and if you did enough crunches, yes, your belly would be flat as a flitter. The similes go on as carbonated beverages can go flat as a flitter, as your hair on a humid day, and if you drive west, all that land, you got it, flitter flat. My favorite times with the word were the last days we had her, when she needed oxygen and ice chips and kept death backed into a corner by calling me a flitterhead. I swore I didn't have her remote, and she didn't believe me until she found it under the covers between her legs. She changed the channel, said, "Okay, flitterhead, I'm sorry, right there was the clicker, right under my flitter, who would have thought?" And it was time to change her, to wipe off the blackest stool with a warm cloth. She kept me from deep sorrow by saying, "Make sure to hit my bald flitter now. Nobody tells you. Every hair falls out down there as you age. And hit it with the douse of powder, Coy. Grandma's gotta stay fresh." I cleaned her as I would a baby, turning her best I could from side to side. And later, when I tired, I called in the nurse to help me hold her so I could change the sheets. The nurse was from an island not far from Florida, but far enough that when our work was done, she stopped me, asked, "I'm sorry, your grandmother, I can't understand her. Can you tell me what language she speaks?" That was when I knew. I wasn't losing my grandmother, no. I was losing my home, the one place I could understand the world through a mother tongue only she could sing. This poem is called "For My Grandmother's Perfume," Norrell. Because your generation didn't wear perfume, but chose a scent, a signature. Every day you spritzed a powerhouse floral with top notes of lavender and mandarin, a loud smell, one part Doris Day, that girl next door who used Technicolor to find a way to laugh about husbands screwing their secretaries over lunch. The rest, all Faye Dunaway, all high drama extensions of nails and lashes, your hair a breezy fall of bangs, a stiletto entrance that knew to walk sideways, hip first. Now, watch a real lady descend the stairs. Launched in 1968, Norell was the 1950s, tingling with the beginnings of disco. Norell was a housewife tired of gospel, mopping her house to Stevie Wonder instead. You wore so much of it, tiny pockets of your ghost lingered hours after you were gone. And last month, I stalked a woman wearing your scent through the grocery so long I abandoned my cart and went home. Fanny, tell me, how can manufactured particles carry you through the air? I always express what I see, but it was no photo that stopped and queased me to my knees. After all these years, you were an invisible trace, and in front of a tower of soup cans, I was a simple animal craving the deep memory worn by a stranger oblivious of me. If I had courage, the kind of fool I'd like to be, I would have pressed my face into her small shoulder, and with the sheer work of two pink lungs, I would have breathed enough to conjure you back to me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
This is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to Nicole Brown reading from her upcoming collection, Fanny Says. This book will be coming out later this year from BOA Edition, so you can look forward to that. Before Nicole's reading, I played a number of poems for you to hear, mainly to hear the difference that the different kinds of poetry that can be written and the different ways it can be performed. This is all part of the Poet Laureate project that I'm running right now called Digging Our Poetic Roots, which invites you to participate. You can receive email blasts from me. I'll share poems and a few words about the craft of poetry as it relates to those poems, and invite you to submit poems for possible publication in an anthology of Sonoma County poets. If you would like more information about this project, please do contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. And you have the chance to hear some live poetry at the Word Temple Poetry Series on Saturday, March 15th. When the poet Clive Mattson will be coming, and he'll be performing his work that night with a wonderful cellist by the name of Gail Alcock, G-A-E-L Alcock. And performing along with Clive Mattson that night will be Marin County poet Roy Mash, who will be celebrating his first full-length collection of poems. This is a night not to be missed. Word Temple Poetry Series at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, 282 South High Street in Sebastopol, and that is Saturday, March 15th at 7 o'clock. For more information, you can go to wordtemple.com. I do hope you enjoyed tonight's program that featured so many poets, I can't even list them all. Anne Sexton, Theodore Retke, Emily Dickinson, Michael McClure, Allen Ginsberg, and of course, Nicole Brown, along with others. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's program, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.